But, of course, the question I ask is different. So, why work at all if you have so much money? Oh, he tried staying home, but you get stir-crazy, you know. You start feeling like an outcast. And this touches me. Somehow even more than the presumptive lie about his assets. That this place he has described as so morbidly dysfunctional could amount to a real and compelling human community. Would I maybe like to go for a walk on the beach someday after work? Yeah, okay. And I bound back to brace myself for lunch. Surprisingly, a number of the more sentient residents seem to recognize me at the lunch service. One of them grips my arm when I bring her ham steak, whispering, "You're a good person, you know that," and repeats the accolade with each item I deliver. Another resident tells me I'm looking gorgeous, and one of the RNs actually remembers my name. This could work, I'm thinking. I will become a luminous beacon in the gathering darkness of dementia, compensating in some cosmic system of justice for the impersonal care my father received in a far less loving facility. I happily fill special requests for ice cream and grilled cheese sandwiches. I laugh at the Barbara Bush joke when it comes up again and again. The saintly mood lasts until I refill the milk glass of a tiny, scabrous old lady with wild white hair, who looks like she's been folded into her wheelchair and squished. "I want to throw you," she seems to be saying. And when I bend down to confirm this improbable aspiration, the old fiend throws the entire glass at me, soaking my khakis from groin to ankle. "Ha-ha," my erstwhile admirers cackle. "She wet her pants." But at least I'm no longer an outcast, as Pete would say, in this strange white state. I have been inducted into a world rich with gossip and intrigue, and now baptized in the whitest of fluids. Saturday, my last night at the Six, and I refuse to spend it crushed in my room. But what is a person of limited means and no taste for carousing to do? Several times during the week, I've driven past the Deliverance Church downtown, and the name alone exerts a scary attraction. Could there really be a whole congregation of people who've never heard of the James Dickey novel and subsequent movie? Or, worse yet, is this band of Christians thoroughly familiar with that story of homosexual rape in the woods? The marquee in front of the church is advertising a Saturday night tent revival, which sounds like the perfect entertainment for an atheist out on her own. I drive through a menacing area filled with deserted warehouses, Dickey be gone, until the tent comes looming up out of the dusk. Unfortunately, from an entertainment point of view, only about 60 of the approximately 300 folding chairs are populated. I count three or four people of color, African and, I would guess, Mexican-Americans. Everyone else is a tragic-looking hillbilly type. My very own people, genetically speaking. Ehrenreich is a name acquired through marriage. My maiden name, Alexander, derives directly from Kentucky. I chat with a woman sitting near me. "Nice night. You come from far?" And things like that. And she lends me her Bible, since I seem to be the only one present without a personal copy. It's a relief when one of the 10 or so men on the stage orders us to stand and start singing, because the folding chair is torturing my overworked back. I even join in the rhythmic clapping and swaying, which seems to define a minimal level of participation. There are a few genuine adepts present who throw themselves rapturously into the music, eyes shut, arms upraised, waiting, no doubt, for the onset of glossolalia. But before anything interesting can happen, the preaching commences. A man in shirt sleeves tells us what a marvelous book the Bible is, and bemoans the fact that people buy so many inferior books when you really need just the one. someone on TV tells you to read some secular book, and then it goes up, you know, what's the word? I think sales is the word he wants, but no one can figure out how to help him. Anyway, it could be 300, and then it's a ratio of 10 to 1. Huh? Next, a Mexican-American fellow takes over the mic, shuts his eyes tight, and delivers a rapid-fire summary of our debt to the crucified Christ. Then it's an older white guy attacking this wicked city for its heretically inadequate contribution of souls to the revival, which costs money, you know. This tent didn't just put itself up. We're talking overhead, he goes on, not someone making money for themselves. And when you consider what Jesus gave so that we could enjoy eternal life with him in heaven. I can't help letting my mind wander to the implications of Alzheimer's disease for the theory of an immortal soul. Who wants an afterlife if the immediate pre-afterlife is spent clutching the arms of a wheelchair? Head bent back at a 45-degree angle, eyes and mouth wide open and equally mute, like so many of my charges at the Woodcrest. Is the soul that lives forever the one we possess at the moment of death? In which case, heaven must look something like the Woodcrest, with plenty of CNAs and dietary aids to take care of those who died in a state of mental decomposition. Or is it our personally best soul? Say the one that indwells in us at the height of our cognitive powers and moral aspirations. In which case, it can't possibly matter whether demented diabetics eat cupcakes or not, because from a purely soteriological standpoint, they're already dead. The preaching goes on, interrupted with dutiful amens. It would be nice if someone would read this sad-eyed crowd the Sermon on the Mount, accompanied by a rousing commentary on income inequality and the need for a hike in the minimum wage. But Jesus makes his appearance here only as a corpse. The living man, the wine-guzzling vagrant and precocious socialist, is never once mentioned, nor anything he ever had to say. Christ crucified rules. And it may be that the true business of modern Christianity is to crucify him again and again, so that he can never get a word out of his mouth. I would like to stay around for the speaking in tongues, should it occur, but the mosquitoes, worked into a frenzy by all this talk of his blood, are launching a full-scale attack. I get up to leave, timing my exit for when the preacher's metronomic head movements have him looking the other way, and walk out to search for my car, half expecting to find Jesus out there in the dark, gagged and tethered to a tent pole. Sunday, I at last move into the Blue Haven, so pleased to be out of the six that the shortcomings of my new home seem minor, even at first endearing. It's smaller than I had recalled, for one thing, since a tool shed used by the motel owners takes up part of my cottage space, and this leads to a certain unfortunate blending of the biological functions. With the toilet less than 4 feet from the tiny kitchen table, I have to close the bathroom door, or I feel like I'm eating in a latrine. And the fact that the head of the bed is about 7 feet from the stove means that the flounder I fry up for my housewarming dinner lingers all night. Frying is pretty much all I can do, since the kitchen equipment is limited to a frying pan, a plate, a small bowl, a coffee maker, and one large drinking glass, without even a proverbial pot to pee in. The idea is improvisation. The foil containers that come from salad bars can be reused as dishes. The lone plate becomes a cutting board. The concavity in the center of the bed is rectified by sleeping on a folded-up towel, and so forth. Not to worry. I have an address, 2 jobs, and a rent-a-rec. The anxiety that gripped me those first few days at the six is finally beginning to ebb. As it turns out, the mere fact of having a unit to myself makes me an aristocrat within the Blue Haven community. The other long-term residents, whom I encounter at the communal laundry shed, are blue-collar people with uniforms and overalls to wash, and generally quiet at night. Mostly they're couples with children, much like the white working-class people occasionally glimpsed on sitcoms, only, unlike their TV counterparts, my neighbors are crowded three or four into an efficiency, or at most, a one-bedroom apartment. One young guy asks which unit I'm in, and then tells me he used to live in that very same one himself, along with two friends. A middle-aged woman with a three-year-old granddaughter in tow tells me, in a comforting tone, that it's always hard at the beginning, living in a motel, especially if you're used to a house, but you adjust after a while. You put it out of your mind. She, for example, has been at the Blue Haven for 11 years now. I am rested and ready for anything when I arrive at the maid's office suite Monday at 7:30 a.m. I know nothing about cleaning services like this one, which, according to the brochure I'm given, has over 300 franchises nationwide, and most of what I know about domestics in general comes from 19th-century British novels and Upstairs Downstairs. Prophetically enough, I caught a rerun of that very show on PBS over the weekend and was struck by how terribly correct the servants looked in their black and white uniforms and how much wiser they were than their callow, egotistical masters. We, too, have uniforms, though they're more oafish than dignified, ill-fitting, and in an over-loud combination of Kelly green pants and a blinding sunflower yellow polo shirt. And, as is explained in writing, and over the next day and a half of training, we, too, have a special code of decorum. No smoking anywhere. Or at least not within 15 minutes of arrival at a house. No drinking, eating, or gum-chewing in a house. No cursing in a house, even if the owner is not present. And, perhaps to keep us in practice, no obscenities even in the office. So, this is downstairs, is my chirpy first thought. But I have no idea, of course, just how far down these stairs will take me. Nationwide, and even international cleaning services like Mary Maids, Molly Maids, and the Maids International, all of which have arisen since the 70s, now control 20 to 25% of the house cleaning business. In a 1997 article about Mary Maids, Franchise Times reported tersely that category is booming, niche is hot, too, as Americans look to outsource work even at home. Not all cleaning services do well, with a high rate of failure among the informal mom-and-pop services, like the one I applied to by phone that didn't even require a cursory interview. All I had to do was show up at 7 the next morning. The boom is concentrated among the national and international chains. Outfits like Mary Maids, Molly Maids, Minnie Maids, Maid Brigade, and the Maids International, all named, curiously enough, to highlight the more antique aspects of the industry, although the maid may occasionally be male. Mary Maids claimed to be growing at 15 to 20% a year in 1996, while spokesmen for Molly Maids and the Maids International each told me in interviews conducted after I left Maine that their firm's sales are growing by 25% a year. 40 minutes go by before anyone acknowledges my presence with more than a harried nod. During this time, the other employees arrive, about 20 of them, already glowing in their uniforms, and breakfast on the free coffee, bagels, and donuts the maids kindly provides for us. All but one of the others are female, with an average age I would guess in the late 20s, though the range seems to go from prom fresh to well into the Medicare years. There's a pleasant sort of bustle as people get their breakfasts and fill plastic buckets with rags and bottles of cleaning fluids, but surprisingly little conversation, outside of a few references to what people ate pizza, and drank, jello shots are mentioned, over the weekend. Since the room in which we gather contains only two folding chairs, both of them occupied, the other new girl and I sit cross-legged on the floor, silent and alert, while the regulars get sorted into teams of three or four and dispatched to the day's list of houses. One of the women explains to me that teams do not necessarily return to the same houses week after week, nor do you have any guarantee of being on the same team from one day to the next. This, I suppose, is one of the advantages of a corporate cleaning service to its customers. There are no sticky and possibly guilt-ridden relationships involved, because the customers communicate almost entirely with Tammy, the office manager, or with Ted, the franchise owner and our boss. The maids' wages, their Social Security taxes, their green cards, backaches, and childcare problems, all these are the sole concern of the company, meaning the local franchise owner. If there are complaints on either side, they're addressed to the franchise owner. The customer and the actual workers need never interact. Since the franchise owner is usually a middle-class white person, cleaning services are the ideal solution for anyone still sensitive enough to find the traditional employer-maid relationship morally vexing. The advantage to the cleaning person is harder to determine. Since the pay compares so poorly to what an independent cleaner is likely to earn, up to $15 an hour, I've heard. While I wait in the inner room, where the phone is and Tammy has her desk, to be issued a uniform, I hear her tell a potential customer on the phone that the maids charges $25 per person hour. The company gets $25, and we get $6.65 for each hour we work? I think I must have misheard. But a few minutes later, I hear her say the same thing to another inquirer. So the only advantage of working here, as opposed to freelancing, is that you don't need a clientele, or even a car. You can arrive straight from welfare, or, in my case, the bus station, fresh off the boat. I don't know what proportion of my fellow workers at the maids in Portland had been on welfare, but the owner of the maids franchise in Andover, Massachusetts, told me in a phone interview that half his employees are former welfare recipients and that they're as reliable as anyone else. At last, after all the other employees have sped off in the company's eye-catching green and yellow cars, I am led into a tiny closet-sized room off the inner office to learn my trade via videotape. The manager at another maid service where I'd applied had told me she didn't like to hire people who had done cleaning before because they were resistant to learning the company's system. So I prepare to empty my mind of all prior house cleaning experience. There are four tapes: dusting, bathrooms, kitchen, and vacuuming, each starring an attractive, possibly Hispanic young woman who moves about serenely in obedience to the male voiceover. For vacuuming, begin in the master bedroom. When dusting, begin with the room directly off the kitchen. When you enter a room, mentally divide it into sections no wider than your reach. Begin in the section to your left, and within each section, move from left to right and top to bottom. This way, nothing is ever overlooked. I like dusting best, for its undeniable logic and a certain kind of austere beauty. When you enter a house, you spray a white rag with Windex and place it in the left pocket of your green apron. Another rag, sprayed with disinfectant, goes into the middle pocket, and a yellow rag bearing wood polish in the right-hand pocket. A dry rag, for buffing surfaces, occupies the right-hand pocket of your slacks. Shiny surfaces get Windexed, wood gets wood polish, and everything else is wiped dust-free with disinfectant. Every now and then, Ted pops in to watch with me, pausing the video to underscore a particularly dramatic moment. See how she's working around the vase? That's an accident waiting to happen. If Ted himself were in a video, it'd have to be a cartoon, because the only features sketched onto his pudgy face are brown button-like eyes and a tiny pug nose. His belly, encased in a polo shirt, overhangs the waistline of his shorts. You know, all this was figured out with a stopwatch, he tells me with something like pride. When the video warns against over-soaking our rags with cleaning fluids, he pauses it to tell me there's a danger in under-soaking, too, especially if it's going to slow me down. Cleaning fluids are less expensive than your time. It's good to know that something is cheaper than my time. Or in the hierarchy of the company's values, I rank above Windex. Vacuuming is the most disturbing video, actually a double feature, beginning with an introduction to the special backpack vacuum we're to use. Yes, the vacuum cleaner actually straps onto your back, a chubby fellow who introduces himself as its inventor explains. He suits up, pulling the straps tight across and under his chest, and then says proudly into the camera, "See? I am the vacuum cleaner." "It weighs only 10 pounds," he claims. Although, as I soon find out, with the attachments dangling from the strap around your waist, the total is probably more like 14. "What about my petulant and much-pampered lower back?" The inventor returns to the theme of human-slash-machine merger. "When properly strapped in, we, too, will be vacuum cleaners, constrained only by the cord that attaches us to an electrical outlet. And vacuum cleaners don't have backaches." Somehow, all this information exhausts me, and I watch the second video, which explains the actual procedures for vacuuming, with the detached interest of a cineast. Could the model maid be an actual maid? And the model home someone's actual dwelling? And who are these people whose idea of decorating is matched pictures of mallard ducks in flight, and whose house is perfectly characterless and pristine, even before the model maid sets to work? At first, I find the videos on kitchens and bathrooms baffling, and it takes me several minutes to realize why. There is no water, or almost no water, involved. I was taught to clean by my mother, a compulsive housekeeper who employed water so hot you needed rubber gloves to get into it, and in such Niagara-like quantities that most microbes were probably crushed by the force of it before the soap suds had a chance to rupture their cell walls. But germs are never mentioned in the videos provided by the maids. Our antagonists exist entirely in the visible world. Soap scum, dust, counter crud, dog hair, stains, and smears. And are to be attacked by damp rag or, in hardcore cases, by Dobie, the brand of plastic scouring pad we use. We scrub only to remove impurities that might be detectable to a customer by hand or by eye. Otherwise, our only job is to wipe. Nothing is said about the possibility of transporting bacteria, by rag or by hand, from bathroom to kitchen, or even from one house to the next. It is the cosmetic touches that the videos emphasize, and that Ted, when he wanders back into the room, continually directs my eye to. Fluff up all throw pillows and arrange them symmetrically. Brighten up stainless steel sinks with baby oil. Leave all spice jars, shampoos, etc., with their labels facing outward. Comb out the fringes of Persian carpets with a pick. Use the vacuum cleaner to create a special fern-like pattern in the carpets. The loose ends of toilet paper and paper towel rolls have to be given a special fold, the same one you'll find in hotel bathrooms. Messes of loose paper, clothing, or toys are to be stacked into neat messes. Finally, the house is to be sprayed with the cleaning service's signature floral-scented air freshener, which will signal to the owners, the moment they return home, that yes, their house has been cleaned. When I described the methods employed by the maids to house cleaning expert Cheryl Mendelson, author of Home Comforts, she was incredulous. A rag moistened with disinfectant will not get a countertop clean, she told me, because most disinfectants are inactivated by contact with organic matter, that is, dirt. So their effectiveness declines with each swipe of the rag. What you need is a detergent and hot water, followed by a rinse. As for floors, she judged the amount of water we used, one half of a small bucket, which was never any warmer than room temperature, to be grossly inadequate, and, in fact, the water I wiped around on floors was often an unsavory gray. I also ran the maid's cleaning methods by Don Aslett, author of numerous books on cleaning techniques and self-styled number one cleaner in America. He was hesitant to criticize the maids directly, perhaps because he is, or told me he is, a frequent speaker at conventions of cleaning service franchise holders. But he did tell me how he would clean a countertop. First, spray it thoroughly with an all-purpose cleaner. Then let it sit for 3 to 4 minutes of kill time. And finally, wipe dry with a clean cloth. Merely wiping the surface with a damp cloth, he said, just spreads the dirt around. But the point at the maid's, apparently, is not to clean so much as to create the appearance of having been cleaned. Not to sanitize, but to create a kind of stage setting for family life. And the stage setting Americans seem to prefer is sterile only in the metaphorical sense, like a motel room, or the fake interiors in which soap operas and sitcoms take place. After a day's training, I am judged fit to go out with a team, where I soon discover that life is nothing like the movies, at least not if the movie is dusting. For one thing, compared with our actual pace, the training videos were all in slow motion. We do not walk to the cars with our buckets full of cleaning fluids and utensils in the morning. We run. And when we pull up to a house, we run with our buckets to the door. Liza, a good-natured woman in her 30s, who's my first team leader, explains that we're only given so many minutes per house, ranging from under 60 for a 1.5-bathroom apartment to 200 or more for a multi-bathroom first-timer. I'd like to know why anybody worries about Ted's time limits if we're being paid by the hour, but hesitate to display anything that might be interpreted as attitude. As we get to each house, Liza assigns our tasks, and I cross my fingers to ward off bathrooms and vacuuming. Even dusting, though, gets aerobic under pressure, and after about an hour of it, reaching to get door tops, crawling along floors to wipe baseboards, standing on my bucket to attack the higher shelves, I wouldn't mind sitting down with a tall glass of water. But as soon as you complete your assigned task, you report to the team leader to be assigned to help someone else. Once or twice, when the normal process of evaporation is deemed too slow, I am assigned to dry a scrubbed floor by putting rags under my feet and skating around on it. Usually, by the time I get out to the car and am dumping the dirty water used on floors and wringing out rags, the rest of the team is already in the car with the motor running. Liza assures me that they've never left anyone behind at a house, not even, presumably, a very new person whom nobody knows. In my interview, I'd been promised a 30-minute lunch break, but this turns out to be a 5-minute pit stop at a convenience store, if that. I bring my own sandwich, the same turkey breast and cheese every day, as do a couple of the others. The rest eat convenience store fare, a bagel or donut salvaged from our free breakfast, or nothing at all. The two older married women I'm teamed up with eat best, sandwiches and fruit. Among the younger women, lunch consists of a slice of pizza, a pizza pocket, a roll of dough surrounding some pizza sauce, or a small bag of chips. Bear in mind, we're not office workers, sitting around idling at the basal metabolic rate. A poster on the wall in the office cheerily displays the number of calories burned per minute at our various tasks, ranging from about 3.5 for dusting to 7 for vacuuming. If you assume an average of 5 calories per minute in a 7-hour day, 8 hours minus time for travel between houses, you need to be taking in 2,100 calories in addition to the resting minimum of, say, 900 or so. I get pushy with Rosalie, who is new like me and fresh from high school in a rural northern part of the state, about the meagerness of her lunches, which consist solely of Doritos, a half bag from the day before, or a freshly purchased small-sized bag. She just didn't have anything in the house, she says, though she lives with her boyfriend and his mother. And she certainly doesn't have any money to buy lunch, as I find out when I offer to fetch her a soda from a Quick Mart, and she has to admit she doesn't have 89 cents. I treat her to the soda, wishing I could force her, mommy-like, to take milk instead. So how does she hold up for an 8 or even 9-hour day? Well, she concedes, I get dizzy sometimes. How poor are they, my co-workers? The fact that anyone is working this job at all can be taken as prima facie evidence of some kind of desperation, or at least a history of mistakes and disappointments. But it's not for me to ask. In the prison movies that provide me with a mental guide to comportment, the new guy doesn't go around shaking hands and asking, "Hi there, what are you in for?" So I listen, in the cars and when we're assembled in the office, and learn, first, that no one seems to be homeless. Almost everyone is embedded in extended families, or families artificially extended with housemates. People talk about visiting grandparents in the hospital, or sending birthday cards to a niece's husband. Single mothers live with their own mothers, or share apartments with a co-worker or boyfriend. Pauline, the oldest of us, owns her own home, but she sleeps on the living room sofa while her 4 grown children and 3 grandchildren fill up the bedrooms. The women I worked with were all white, and with one exception, Anglo, as are the plurality of house cleaners in America, or at least those known to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Of the private household cleaners and servants it managed to locate in 1998, the BLS reports that 36.8% were Hispanic, 15.8% Black, and 2.7% other. However, the association between house cleaning and minority status is well established in the psyches of the white employing class. When my daughter Rosa was introduced to the father of a wealthy Harvard classmate, he ventured that she must have been named for a favorite maid. And Audre Lorde reported an experience she had in 1967. I wheel my 2-year-old daughter in a shopping cart through a supermarket, and a little white girl riding past in her mother's cart calls out excitedly, "Oh, look, Mommy, a baby maid!" But the composition of the household workforce is hardly fixed and has changed with the life chances of the different ethnic groups. In the late 19th century, Irish and German immigrants served the urban upper and middle classes, then left for the factories as soon as they could. Black women replaced them, accounting for 60% of all domestics in the 1940s, and dominated the field until other occupations began to open up to them. Similarly, West Coast maids were disproportionately Japanese-American, until that group, too, found more congenial options. Today, the color of the hand that pushes the sponge varies from region to region. Chicanas in the Southwest, Caribbeans in New York, Native Hawaiians in Hawaii, Native whites, many of recent rural extraction in the Midwest, and, of course, Maine. So, although no one, apparently, is sleeping in a car, there are signs, even at the beginning, of real difficulty, if not actual misery. Half-smoked cigarettes are returned to the pack, There are discussions about who will come up with 50 cents for a toll and whether Ted can be counted on for prompt reimbursement. One of my teammates gets frantic about a painfully impacted wisdom tooth and keeps making calls from our houses to try to locate a source of free dental care. When my, or I should say Liza's, team discovers there's not a single Dobie in our buckets, I suggest that we stop at a convenience store and buy one, rather than drive all the way back to the office. But it turns out I haven't brought any money with me, and we cannot put together $2 between the four of us. The Friday of my first week at the Maids is unnaturally hot for Maine in early September, 95 degrees according to the digital time and temperature displays offered by banks that we pass. I'm teamed up with the sad-faced Rosalie and our leader, Maddie, whose sullenness, under the circumstances, is almost a relief after Liza's relentless good cheer. Liza, I've learned, is the highest-ranking cleaner, a sort of supervisor, really, and said to be something of a snitch. But Maddie, a single mom of maybe 27 or so, has worked for only 3 months and broods about her childcare problems. Her boyfriend's sister, she tells me on the drive to our first house, watches her 18-month-old for $50 a week, which is a stretch on the maid's pay. Plus, she doesn't entirely trust the sister, but a real daycare center could be as much as $90 a week. After polishing off the first house, no problem, we grab lunch. Doritos for Rosalie and a bag of Pepperidge Farm goldfish for Maddie, and head out into the exurbs for what our instruction sheet warns is a 5-bathroom spread and a first-timer to boot. Still, the size of the place makes us pause for a moment, buckets in hand, before searching out an appropriately humble entrance. It sits there like a beached ocean liner, the prow cutting through swells of green turf, windows without number. "Well, well," Maddie says, reading the owner's name from our instruction sheet. "Mrs. W. and her big-ass house. I hope she's going to give us lunch." For the affluent, houses have been swelling with no apparent limit. The square footage of new homes increased by 39% between 1971 and 1996 to include family rooms, home entertainment rooms, home offices, bedrooms, and often a bathroom for each family member. By the second quarter of 1999, 17% of new homes were larger than 3,000 square feet, which is usually considered the size threshold for household help, or the point at which a house becomes unmanageable to the people who live in it. Mrs. W. is not, in fact, happy to see us, grimacing with exasperation when the black nanny ushers us into the family room, or sunroom, or den, or whatever kind of specialized space she's sitting in. After all, she already has the nanny, a cook-like person, and a crew of men doing some sort of finishing touches on the construction to supervise. No, she doesn't want to take us around the house, because she already explained everything to the office on the phone. But Maddie stands there, with Rosalie and me behind her, until she relents. "We are to move everything on all surfaces," she instructs during the tour, "and get underneath and be sure to do every bit of the several miles, I calculate, of baseboards, and be mindful of the baby, who's napping, and can't have cleaning fluids of any kind near her." Then I am let loose to dust. In a situation like this, where I don't even know how to name the various kinds of rooms, the maid's special system turns out to be a lifesaver. All I have to do is keep moving from left to right, within rooms, and between rooms, trying to identify landmarks so I don't accidentally do a room or a hallway twice. Dusters get the most complete biographical overview, due to the necessity of lifting each object and tchotchke individually. And I learned that Mrs. W. is an alumna of an important women's college, now occupying herself by monitoring her investments and the baby's bowel movements. I find special charts for this latter purpose, with spaces for time of day, most recent fluid intake, consistency, and color. In the master bedroom, I dust a whole shelf of books on pregnancy, breastfeeding, the first 6 months, the first year, the first 2 years, and I wonder what the child care deprived Maddie makes of all this. Maybe there's been some secret division of the world's women into breeders and drones, and those at the maid level are no longer supposed to be reproducing at all. Maybe this is why our office manager, Tammy, who was once a maid herself, wears inch-long fake nails and tardy little outfits to show she's advanced to the breeder caste and can't be sent out to clean anymore. It's hotter inside than out. Un-air-conditioned for the benefit of the baby, I suppose. But I do all right until I encounter the banks of glass doors that line the side and back of the ground floor. Each one has to be Windexed, wiped, and buffed, inside and out, top to bottom, left to right, until it's as streakless and invisible as a material substance can be. Outside, I can see the construction guys knocking back Gatorade, but the rule is that no fluid or food item can touch a maid's lips when she's inside a house. Now, sweat, even in unseemly quantities, is nothing new to me. I live in a subtropical area where even the inactive can expect to be moist 9 months out of the year. I work out, too, in my normal life, and take a certain macho pride in the V's of sweat that form on my T-shirt after 10 minutes or more on the Stairmaster. But in normal life, fluids lost are immediately replaced. Everyone in yuppie land, airports, for example, looks like a nursing baby these days, inseparable from their plastic bottles of water. Here, however, I sweat without replacement or pause, not in individual drops, but in continuous sheets of fluid soaking through my polo shirt, pouring down the backs of my legs. The eyeliner I put on in the morning, vain twit that I am, has long since streaked down onto my cheeks, and I could wring my braid out if I wanted to. Working my way through the living rooms, I wonder if Mrs. W. will ever have occasion to realize that every single doodad and objet through which she expresses her unique individual self is, from another vantage point, only an obstacle between some thirsty person and a glass of water. When I can find no more surfaces to wipe and have finally exhausted the supply of rooms, Maddie assigns me to do the kitchen floor. Okay, except that Mrs. W. is in the kitchen, so I have to go down on my hands and knees, practically at her feet. No, we don't have sponge mops like the one I use in my own house. The hands and knees approach is a definite selling point for corporate cleaning services like the maid's. We clean floors the old-fashioned way, on our hands and knees, the brochure for a competing firm boasts. In fact, whatever advantages there may be to the hands and knees approach, you're closer to your work, of course, and less likely to miss a grimy patch, are undermined by the artificial drought imposed by the maid's cleaning system. We're instructed to use less than half a small bucket of lukewarm water for a kitchen and all adjacent scrubbable floors, breakfast nooks, and other dining areas, meaning that within a few minutes, we're doing nothing more than redistributing the dirt evenly around the floor. There are occasional customer complaints about the cleanliness of our floors. For example, from a man who wiped up a spill on his freshly cleaned floor, only to find the paper towel he employed for this purpose had turned gray. A mop and a full bucket of hot soapy water would not only get a floor cleaner, but would be a lot more dignified for the person who does the cleaning. But it's this primal posture of submission, and of what is ultimately anal accessibility, that seems to gratify the consumers of maid services. In Home Comforts, The Art of Science in Keeping House, Cheryl Mendelson writes, "Never ask hired house cleaners to clean your floors on their hands and knees. The request is likely to be regarded as degrading." I don't know. But Mrs. W.'s floor is hard. Stone, I think, or at least a stone-like substance. And we have no knee pads with us today. I had thought, in my middle-class innocence, that knee pads were one of Monica Lewinsky's prurient fantasies. But no, they actually exist. And they're usually a standard part of our equipment. So, here I am on my knees, working my way around the room like some fanatical penitent crawling through the stations of the cross, when I realize that Mrs. W. is staring at me fixedly. So fixedly that I'm gripped for a moment by the wild possibility that I may have once given a lecture at her alma mater, and she's trying to figure out where she's seen me before. If I were recognized, would I be fired? Would she at least be inspired to offer me a drink of water? Because I've decided that if water is actually offered, I'm taking it, rules or no rules. And if word of this infraction gets back to Ted, I'll just say I thought it would be rude to refuse. Not to worry, though. She's just watching that I don't leave out some stray square inch. And when I rise painfully to my feet again, blinking through the sweat, she says, "Could you just scrub the floor in the entryway while you're at it?" I rush home to the Blue Haven at the end of the day, pull down the blinds for privacy, strip off my uniform in the kitchen, the bathroom being too small for both a person and her discarded clothes, and stand in the shower for a good 10 minutes, thinking, all this water is mine. I have paid for it. In fact, I have earned it. I have gotten through a week at the maid's without mishap, injury, or insurrection. My back feels fine, meaning I'm not feeling it at all. Even my wrists, damaged by carpal tunnel syndrome years ago, are issuing no complaints. Co-workers warned me that the first time they donned the backpack vacuum, they felt faint, but not me. I am strong, and I am, more than that, good. Did I toss my bucket of filthy water onto Mrs. W.'s casual white summer outfit? No. Did I take the wand of my vacuum cleaner and smash someone's Chinese porcelain statues or Hummel figurines? Not once. I was at all times cheerful, energetic, helpful, and as competent as a new hire can be expected to be. If I can do 1 week, I can do another, and might as well, since there's never been a moment for job hunting. The 3:30 quitting time turns out to be a myth. Often we don't return to the office until 4:30 or 5. And what did I think? That I was going to go out to interviews in my soaked and stinky post-work condition? I decide to reward myself with a sunset walk on Old Orchard Beach. On account of the heat, there are still a few actual bathers on the beach, but I'm content to sit in shorts and t-shirt and watch the ocean pummel the sand. When the sun goes down, I walk back into the town to find my car and am amazed to hear a sound I associate with cities like New York and Berlin. There's a couple of Peruvian musicians playing in the little grassy island in the street near the pier, and maybe 50 people, locals and vacationers, have gathered around, offering their bland end-of-summer faces to the sound. I edge my way through the crowd and find a seat where I can see the musicians up close, the beautiful young guitarist and the taller man playing the flute. What are they doing in this rinky-dink blue-collar resort? And what does the audience make of this surprise visit from the dark-skinned South? The melody the flute lays out over the percussion is both utterly strange and completely familiar, as if it had been imprinted in the minds of my own peasant ancestors centuries ago and forgotten until this very moment. Everyone else seems to be as transfixed as I am. The musicians wink and smile at each other as they play, and I see then that they are the secret emissaries of a worldwide lower-class conspiracy to snatch joy out of degradation and filth. When the song ends, I give them a dollar, the equivalent of about 10 minutes of sweat. The superwoman mood doesn't last. For one thing, while the muscles and joints are doing just fine, the skin has decided to rebel. At first I think the itchy pink bumps on my arms and legs must be poison ivy picked up at a lockout. Sometimes an owner forgets we're coming, or forgets to leave a key under the mat, or changes his or her mind about the service without thinking to notify Ted. This is not, for us, an occasion for joy, like a snow day for the grade school crowd, because Ted blames us for his customers' fecklessness. When owners forget we're coming, he explains at one of our morning send-off meetings, it means something. Like that they're dissatisfied and too passive-aggressive to tell us. Once, when I'm with Pauline as my team leader, she calls Ted to report a lockout, and his response, she reports ruefully, is, "Don't do this to me." So before we give up and declare a place a lockout, we search like cat burglars for alternative points of entry, which can mean trampling through overgrowth to peer into windows and test all the doors. I haven't seen any poison ivy, but who knows what other members of the poison family, oak, sumac, etc., lurk in the flora of Maine. Or maybe the cleaning fluids are at fault, except that then the rash should have begun on my hands. After 2 days of minor irritation, a full-scale epidermal breakdown is underway. I cover myself with anti-itch cream from Rite Aid, but can manage to sleep only for an hour and a half at a time before the torment resumes. I wake up realizing I can work, but probably shouldn't, if only because I look like a leper. Ted doesn't have much sympathy for illness, though. One of our morning meetings was on the subject of working through it. Somebody, and he wasn't going to name names, he told us, was out with a migraine. Now, if I get a migraine, I just pop 2 Excedrins and get on with my life. That's what you have to do. Work through it. So it's in the spirit of a scientific experiment that I present myself at the office, wondering if my speckled and inflamed appearance will be enough to get me sent home. Certainly I wouldn't want anyone who looks like me handling my children's toys or bars of bathroom soap, but no problem. Must be a latex allergy, is Ted's diagnosis. Just stay out of the latex gloves we use for particularly nasty work. He'll give me another kind to wear. I should, if I were going to stay in character, find an emergency room after work and try to cop a little charitable care. But it's too much. The itching gets so bad at night that I have mini tantrums, waving my arms and stamping my feet to keep from scratching or bawling. So I fall back on the support networks of my real-life social class, call the dermatologist I know in Key West, and bludgeon him into prescribing something sight unseen. The whole episode, including anti-itch cream, prednisone cream, and Benadryl to get through the nights, eats up $30. It's still unseasonably hot, and I often get to look out on someone's azure pool while I vacuum or scrub, frantic with suppressed itching. Even the rash-free are affected by the juxtaposition of terrible heat and cool, inaccessible water. In the car, on one of the hottest days, after cleaning a place with pool house, and gazebo, Rosalie and Maddie and I obsess about immersion in all imaginable forms. Saltwater versus fresh, lakes versus pools, surf versus smooth, glass-like surfaces. We can't even wash our hands in the houses, at least not after the sinks have been dried and buffed. And when I do manage to get a wash in before the sinks are off limits, there's always some filthy last-minute job like squeezing out the rags used on floors once we get out of a house. Maybe I picked up some bug at a house, or maybe it's the disinfectant I squirt on my hands straight from the bottle in an attempt at cleanliness. 3 days into the rash, I make another trip to Old Orchard Beach and wade into the water with my clothes on. I didn't think to bring a bathing suit from Key West to Maine, trying to pretend that it's an accident when a wave washes over me, and that I'm not just some pathetic street person using the beach as a bathtub. There's something else working against my mood of muscular elation. I had been gloating internally about my ability to keep up with, and sometimes outwork, women 20 or 30 years younger than myself. But it turns out this comparative advantage says less about me than it does about them. Ours is a physical bond, to the extent that we bond at all. One person's infirmity can be a teammate's extra burden. There's a constant traffic in herbal and over-the-counter solutions to pain. If I don't know how my coworkers survive on their wages or what they make of our hellish condition, I do know about their back pains and cramps and arthritic attacks. Lori and Pauline are excused from vacuuming on account of their backs, which means you dread being assigned to a team with them. Helen has a bum foot, which Ted, in explaining her absence one day, blames on the cheap, ill-fitting shoes that, he implies, she perversely chooses to wear. Marge's arthritis makes scrubbing a torture. Another woman has to see a physical therapist for her rotator cuff. When Rosalie tells me that she got her shoulder problem picking blueberries as a kid, and she still is one in my eyes, of course, I flash on a scene from my own childhood of wandering through fields on an intense July day, grabbing berries by the handful as I go. But when Rosalie was a kid, she worked in the blueberry fields of northern Maine, and the damage to her shoulder is an occupational injury. So ours is a world of pain, managed by Excedrin and Advil, compensated for with cigarettes, and in one or two cases, and then only on weekends, with booze. Do the owners have any idea of the misery that goes into rendering their homes motel perfect? Would they be bothered if they did know? Or would they take a sadistic pride in what they've purchased, boasting to dinner guests, for example, that their floors are cleaned only with the purest of fresh human tears? In one of my few exchanges with an owner, a pert, muscular woman whose desk reveals that she works part-time as a personal trainer, I'm vacuuming, and she notices the sweat. "That's a real workout, isn't it?" she observes, not unkindly, and actually offers me a glass of water, the only such offer I ever encounter. Flouting the rule against the ingestion of anything while inside a house, I take it, leaving an inch undrunk to avoid the awkwardness of a possible refill offer. "I tell all my clients," the trainer informs me, "if you want to be fit, just fire your cleaning lady and do it yourself." "Ho, ho," is all I say, since we're not just chatting in the gym together, and I can't explain that this form of exercise is totally asymmetrical, brutally repetitive, and as likely to destroy the musculoskeletal structure as to strengthen it. Self-restraint becomes more of a challenge when the owner of a million-dollar condo, that's my guess anyway, because it has three floors and a wide-angle view of the fabled rock-bound coast, who is, according to a framed photograph on the wall, an acquaintance of the real Barbara Bush, takes me into the master bathroom to explain the difficulties she's been having with the shower stall. Seems its marble walls have been bleeding onto the brass fixtures. And can I scrub the grouting extra hard? "That's not your marble bleeding," I want to tell her. "It's the worldwide working class. The people who quarried the marble, wove your Persian rugs until they went blind, harvested the apples in your lovely fall-themed dining room centerpiece, smelted the steel for the nails, drove the trucks, put up this building, and now bend and squat and sweat to clean it." Not that I, even in my more histrionic moments, imagine that I am a member of that oppressed working class. My very ability to work tirelessly hour after hour is a product of decades of better-than-average medical care, a high-protein diet, and workouts in gyms that charge $400 or $500 a year. If I am now a productive fake member of the working class, it's because I haven't been working, in any hard physical sense, long enough to have ruined my body. But I will say this for myself. I have never employed a cleaning person or service, except on two occasions to prepare my house for a short-term tenant, even though various partners and husbands have badgered me over the years to do so. When I could have used one, when the kids were little, I couldn't afford it. And later, when I could afford it, I still found the idea repugnant. Partly this comes from having a mother who believed that a self-cleaned house was the hallmark of womanly virtue. Partly it's because my own normal work is sedentary, so that the housework I do, in dabs of 15 minutes here and 30 minutes there, functions as a break. But mostly I rejected the idea. Even after all my upper-middle-class friends had, guiltily and as covertly as possible, hired help for themselves. Because this is just not the kind of relationship I want to have with another human being. Let's talk about shit, for example. It happens, as the bumper sticker says. And it happens to a cleaning person every day. The first time I encountered a shit-stained toilet as a maid, I was shocked by the sense of unwanted intimacy. A few hours ago, some well-fed butt was straining away on this toilet seat, and now here I am wiping up after it. For those who have never cleaned a really dirty toilet, I should explain that there are three kinds of shit stains. There are the remnants of landslides running down the inside of toilet bowls. There are the splashback remains on the underside of toilet seats. And, perhaps most repulsively, there's sometimes a crust of brown on the rim of a toilet seat, where a turd happened to collide on its dive to the water. You don't want to know this? Well, it's not something I would have chosen to dwell on myself. But the different kinds of stains require different cleaning approaches. One prefers those that are interior to the toilet bowl, since they can be attacked by brush, which is a kind of action-at-a-distance weapon. And one dreads the crusts on the seats, especially when they require the intervention of adobe as well as a rag. Or we might talk about that other great nemesis of the bathroom cleaner, pubic hair. I don't know what it is about the American upper class, but they seem to be shedding their pubic hair at an alarming rate. You find it in quantity in shower stalls, bathtubs, jacuzzis, drains, and even, unaccountably, in sinks. Once I spent 15 minutes crouching in a huge four-person jacuzzi, maddened by the effort of finding the dark little coils camouflaged against the eggplant-colored ceramic background, but fascinated by the image of the pubes of the economic elite, which must by this time be completely bald. There are worse things that owners can do, of course, than shit or shed. They can spy on us, for example. When I ask a teammate why the rule against cursing in houses, she says that owners have been known to leave tape recorders going while we work. Video cameras are another part of the lore, positioned near valuables to catch a cleaner in an act of theft. Whether any of this is true or not, Ted encourages us to imagine that we are under surveillance at all times in each house. At the time, I dismissed this as a scare story, but I've since come across ads for concealable video cameras like the Tech 7, incredible coin-sized camera, designed to get a visual record of your babysitter's actions and watch employees to prevent theft. Other owners set traps for us. In one house, I'm reprimanded by the team leader for failing to vacuum far enough under the Persian rugs scattered around on the hardwood floors, because this owner likes to leave little mounds of dirt there, just so she can see if they're still there when we're done. More commonly, owners will arrange to be home when we come, so they can check up on us while we work. I'm vacuuming the home of a retired couple, and happen to look into a room I've completed, where I see the female owner's enormous purple-encased butt staring up at me from the floor. I wouldn't have thought she was agile enough, but she's climbed under a desk to search out particles of overlooked dust. In 1999, Somewhere between 14% and 18% of households employed an outsider to do the cleaning. And the numbers are rising dramatically. MediaMark Research reports a 53% increase between 1995 and 1999 in the number of households using a hired cleaner or service once a month or more. And Maritz Marketing finds that 30% of the people who hired help in 1999 had done so for the first time that year. Managers of the new corporate cleaning services, such as the one I worked for, attribute their success not only to the influx of women into the workforce, but to the tensions over housework that arose in its wake. When the trend toward hiring out was just beginning to take off in 1988, the owner of a Merry Maids franchise in Arlington, Massachusetts, told the Christian Science Monitor, "I kid some women. I say, we even save marriages. In this new 80s period, you expect more from the male partner. But very often you don't get the cooperation you would like to have. The alternative is to pay somebody to come in." Another Merry Maids franchise owner has learned to capitalize more directly on housework-related spats. He closes 30 to 35% of his sales by making follow-up calls Saturdays between 9 and 11 a.m., which is prime time for arguing over the fact that the house is a mess. I would say more about the houses themselves, but I lack the vocabulary for all the forms of wall finishings, flooring materials, light fixtures, fireplace equipment, porches, and statuary we encounter. On the subject of interior decorating, my general feeling has long been that it's too bad we're furless and have to live indoors. The various consequences of this infirmity, as manifested in architecture, furniture, etc., have never managed to engage my attention. Far more useful to me for understanding the tics, pretensions, and insecurities of the owner class are books and other print-related artifacts. I learned that one of our owners is a Scientologist. Another proudly claims descent from one of the same Scottish clans my own ancestors belonged to. Still another has framed a certificate announcing that she is listed in the who's who of American women. As for books, at the low end of the literacy spectrum, which is where most of our clients dwell, I find Grisham and Limbaugh. At the high end, there's a lot of Amy Tan, and I once even spotted an Ondaatje. Mostly, though, books are for show, and real life, judging from the quantity of food stains and tossed items of clothing, goes on in the room that houses the large screen TV. The only books that seriously offend me are the antique ones, no doubt purchased in bulk, that are sometimes deployed on end tables for purposes of quaintness and authenticity. As if the owners actually spent their spare moments reading a 1920 title like Bobsledding in Vermont, One Boy's Adventure. But time pressures inevitably curtail my literary investigations. The real issue for a maid is the number of books per shelf. If that number is greater than 12, we can treat them as a single mass and dust around them. Otherwise, each one must be removed and dusted separately. Not all of our owners are rich. Maybe a quarter to a third of the houses look to be merely middle class, and some of these, probably because they lack interim help to do the light cleaning between our visits every week or two, are seriously dirty. But class is a relative thing. Once, after polishing up two houses in which the number of occupants clearly exceeded the number of bathrooms, an unmistakable sign of financial impairment, along with the presence of teddy bears in decorative rolls, I asked Holly, my team leader of the day, whether the next house on our list was wealthy. Her answer? If we're cleaning their house, they're wealthy. It is undeniably fall when I find myself being assigned day after day to Holly's team. There's fog in the morning now, and the farm stands are pushing pumpkins. On the radio in our company car, the classic rock station notes the season by playing Maggie May several times a day. It's late September and I really should be back at school. Other people are going out to their offices or classrooms. We stay behind, Cinderella-like, in their usually deserted homes. On the pop station, it's Pearl Jam's hypnotic last kiss, so beautifully sad it makes bereavement seem like an enviable condition. Not that we ever comment on what the radio brings us, or on any other part of the world outside the maids and its string of client houses. In this, the most dutiful and serious of all the teams I've been on, the conversation